Speaking of which, it's over 7 miles down to the deepest part of the Pacific Ocean. The pressure there is more than 1,000 atmospheres. But what's actually down there, if anything, and how can we find out?
My name is Alan Jameson. I'm a research fellow at the University of Aberdeen's Ocean Lab, and what I primarily work on is the exploration of the deepest points in the ocean, which is basically made up of the deep subduction trenches around the Pacific Rim. And what we do is we have designed video cameras and still cameras that can descend through the water column and hit the seafloor completely unattached and unmanned, and they take footage of animals attracted to bait. And they'll do that for up to 24 hours, and at the end of the experimental period, we send an acoustic command to these systems, and they drop ballast weights and float to the surface, and we download them, see what we filmed, and on top of that, we also have some traps positioned around the bottom of the lander to catch small scavenging species.
And they're dragged up too?
Yes, they are, yeah.
When you say deep, when you're talking about these sorts of trenches, how deep's deep?
The trench you're looking at is a biological zone that's called the Hadal Zone, so it's actually deeper than the abyss. The abyss is technically 3,000 to 6,000 metres. What we're looking at is the Hadal Zone, which is 6,000 to 11,000 metres, which is about 5 to 7 miles deep.
Just paint a picture of what it looks like. What's it like down there?
Dark. Primarily dark. There's absolutely no solar light influence whatsoever beyond about 1,000 metres, so... if there is any light, it's probably biological, produced light, bioluminescence. The trench habitat is a kind of characteristic V-shape and cross-section. When you see images of trenches in journals and on TV and stuff like that, they tend to exaggerate the vertical scale. So when you look at a whole trench, it's probably not quite as steep as you'd imagine, but there are places which we've seen and which we can see on charts that are up to 45, 50-degree slopes.
And how much life is down there?
Far more than you would think. I think when we started this in 2006, there wasn't really much information to go on. Pretty much all the big sampling expeditions happened in the 1950s. It was the Danish Galathea and the Russian Vichas expeditions went out, and they did lots of trawling and grabbing all around the Pacific. And since then, nobody really did anything at all. So what we've been trying to do is deploy our camera systems as many different trenches as possible, because what we're seeing is similar trends in each trench. And what seems to happen is certain species become far more abundant as the deeper you go. So when you go to 10,000 metres, for example, we see more of an animal called an amphipod than you'll see anywhere else in the ocean.
Are these big creatures, or are we at that depth down at the scale of microbes and tiny stuff only?
No, I wouldn't say they were big creatures, but the amphipods that turn up, I mean, after a couple of hours of filming, we see several thousand in the view of the camera, and they're all maybe between 10, 20 millimetres long. Down to 8,000 metres, we find fish that can be up to 30 centimetres long quite easily. So when we see brittle stars and holothurians and things like that of exactly the same size, you would find them off the coast of Scotland.
Now, you mentioned that you look at multiple trenches. So given that you've got a species sitting in the bottom of those trenches, and between the trenches you have a ridge of shallower water, organisms cannot spread from the depths of one trench into the next trench because that ridge is in the way. So do you end up with very unique ecosystems down there then in these deep places?
Yeah, what you're referring to is what we call abyssal partitioning. It means that the Hadal Zone has been partitioned by often vast 1,000-kilometre sort of spans of abyssal plain. But in some species what you find is they only seem to exist at the very deep point in one trench, and then you'll find them again at the very deep point in another trench. If you look in between, they're not there. So... there's two explanations for that. One could be that it had a common ancestor that was capable of going shallower, and for some reason the shallow end of the population has since died out. It could be that the previous population was capable of traversing across these ridges.
And when you recover these animals up, are you able to get clues from working on them how they tolerate those environments that they inhabit under those extraordinary conditions?
Yes, it's not quite the line of research we've been doing ourselves, but there is a little bit of work that's going on based on some of our samples, and it does seem to be there's been able to cope with high hydrostatic pressure. I mean, we're talking about up to a ton per square centimetre and very low temperatures, which is normally less than 2. So, you know, being able to adapt to these is obviously a prerequisite to survival, so they all do it. And what we're finding is there's some taxa that doesn't quite make it all the way to the deep, and there's some that do quite happily. It's on a cellular level, of course. We're finding differences in the genes as well from the high-pressure animals compared to shallow-water animals. So there's definitely a high-pressure adaptation there.
And apart from the obvious academic interest of exploring in detail an area which has largely been neglected, what else are you able to glean from doing this? What's the other spin-off from it?
Well, our ultimate goal, I guess, in the future, maybe not at this stage, because trying to biologically map these trenches is an enormous task. I mean, we think we've done lots and lots of deployments, but if you look at the scale of a trench, you're like, yeah. So, but I mean, ultimately, what we're thinking of is the ocean is the ocean. It's the ocean from the top to the bottom. And it's particularly now when we've got a changing environment and things like that. Ocean conservation is tend to be, it's a kind of anthropocentric opinion that the deeper you are, the less important it is. But the ocean should be considered as a whole, not just necessarily the depth to which you can dive and take nice photographs. So yeah, it all plays a big part. And furthermore, there seems to be the trenches are playing a fairly major role in carbon cycling as well, because ultimately all the sediment in the deep abyssal plains ends up being subducted back into the Earth's mantle. And if all the carbon that's taken up in the surface layer eventually dies, sinks to the bottom, and is consumed and recycled and buried, etc., eventually it will end up in the trenches. So that's a new line of research which is just beginning in other institutes.
Have you got any evidence that man's activities could impact on that, or are you trying to quantify how important or what sort of contribution it does make to carbon handling?
In terms of carbon handling, I'm not sure. I know that almost certainly man has had an impact at those kind of depths. I saw an image recently at a conference from Challenger Deep, deepest place in the world, and one of the first things they found when they got there was a raincoat.
I guess that's what they call a water jacket. Aberdeen marine biologist Alan Jameson, whose other claim to fame is having a new species of shrimp named after him. Princaxella jamesoni is white and it's about 6 centimetres long and lives several thousand metres underwater. Alan's a bit bigger, but he does spend quite a bit of time at sea.